Man, we are spoiled rotten in that department. There's no question about that. Well, here we are, Easter morning, and we do have a PowerPoint, guys, so if you want to put that screen down, and we'll put it up at the end, because I know we hide that nice window lots of times, so we'll put that up at the end. We're going to do a little worship at the end. Listen, we've already said it, but let me just say it again. We're here. This is the single most important event to transpire in human history. There's churches all over the globe right now worshiping and recognizing the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which is kind of interesting, you know, in today's world. I mean, we're such a rationalistic, scientific world, you know, it's like we have this thing where we don't really quite believe stuff unless there's unquestionable proof or scientific empirical evidence, you know, and yet there are millions, even into the billions of people that are still going to church. Some maybe are going because it's tradition. Many actually believe it in spite of our rationalistic adherence to scientific proof. We still have to recognize there's something within us that just knows there's another dimension, even though we can't see it. We know it's real, you know, and somebody says, oh, I don't really believe it's real, and then you shut them in a dark room with a dead body, and all of a sudden they're like scared. How come? What, do you believe there's another dimension? Ooh. There is, and we're here to recognize it, you know, but let's face it, in this world, it gets tough. You get challenged, and we all live in a world, I think, let's just be honest, we're all a mixture of faith and doubt. There's times when you doubt, and doubt is good. If you didn't doubt, you'd believe anything. You know, we've got to be able to question things and be able to work it through. I always say that doubt makes a good servant, but a terrible master. And it's good to utilize that and to think things through. I hate when people from either camp, the believers or the non-believers, are so darn arrogant, and they always act like the one on the other side of the camp. If you had half a brain, you'd come over to our camp and look at them as though they're foolish and evil. You know, Isaiah didn't say that. He said, come on, let's come together. Let's reason together. There's a lot to be reasoned, but the bottom line is that the power of God has to touch you. It's not intellectual suicide. There's a lot of great teachings. We have more than ever. And I'm not going to get into that this morning, but I do want to just show you one answer that I really enjoy, or I think is kind of a good one. And it's just the question, you know, if it comes to believing or doubting, or being a Christian or an atheist, a follower of God, or believing that God doesn't exist, here's one good thing you can always count on or realize. After an atheist dies, they will never get to consciously know if they were right, only if they were wrong. The believer will only get to consciously know if they were right, but not if they were wrong. That's kind of cool, right? The atheist, if he's wrong, moment after death, whoops, there he is, I guess I was wrong. On the other hand, the believer, if he was wrong, well, then you just cease to exist and you never get to know. I wish I had a teacher like that. You know, only let me know when I got the test right, but didn't bother to, you know, say anything to me when I got the test wrong. But let's face it, that's really not the way to go about things, right? To just willingly, you know, just go forward and go with it, because you know what? I'm not going to find out if I'm wrong anyway, so let's just go with it, and I don't want to hear anything else. I'm blissfully ignorant right now, so let me just Go ahead with my faith. I don't want to hear about it. And I think we all have different areas where maybe we go in that place. Like, I just don't want to know the truth. All right, I'm happy where I am. That happened to us, interestingly, not too long ago. My daughter, Tara, took a month and went to Spain because she's majoring in Spanish, and they tell you you should immerse yourself in another country when that helps you to become more fluent. And, of course, so she went away. She has to bring us back something, you know. So she brings us back this amazing pepperoni from Spain. Are those things, like, wild or what? I mean, they're encapsulated in some kind of skin, and they last forever. You don't even have to refrigerate them. I mean, we put this thing on top of the refrigerator. When she brought it back, it sat there for 5 months, from like July to December, and then we busted it out for Christmas, you know? And we cut it, and I mean, let's face it, man, a really good pepperoni, right? It's kind of got that bite. It's got a little spice to it, you know, a little kick, and you, maybe with a little cheese or cracker. There's nothing quite like it, you know, and we started eating that. And then, of course, the thought does come to you, man, this is kind of a mysterious item. Like, what's in this thing anyway? And it's like, I don't want to even know, you know. I don't want to know the truth in this case. Just let me be blissfully ignorant. You know, all those little white specks in there, as far as I'm concerned, they're vitamins, okay? Right? Man, this is, I don't want to know the truth. And I guess if this is our foundation for being a believer, then, you know, that's not really the right way to go about it either. So that's one thing, but that's a pretty weak foundation to go on. We don't want to go on that one, just because if I'm wrong, I'll never find out anyway. So there's one other approach that I thought was kind of interesting, and that is if we're wrong about Jesus, then, well, an interview once with with a monk. It's a wonderful monastery he was head of. And, you know, I mean, these guys are amazing. I mean, the way they dedicate themselves to God, some of them take vows of poverty, feeding the poor. They spend hours in solitude and silence. And the interviewer was fascinated with it. And he was like, you know, asking him about spending all that time in silence and solitude. And then he came. He asked him the question. He just said, listen, if, you know, what if at one point it comes to a place and you realize, let's say even at the end of your life, that atheism is true and that there is no God. Tell me, what if that was true? And the abbot or the head monk had this to say. It was kind of interesting. Holiness, silence, and sacrifice are beautiful in themselves. Even without the promise of reward, I still will have used my life well. I thought, man, that's kind of like has a nice nobility to it, you know, romantic ring. And I've said that, you know, I've thought it through, like, you know, when I have my doubts and I'm like, well, you know what? Even if there wasn't a God, was it really a waste? I mean, I prayed with people. Okay, if there really wasn't a God, then we were praying to something imaginative, but they felt better anyway. Help some people pay the rent, help some other people out, buy some groceries. We sent money overseas to people who were dying of starvation. It really wasn't a life spent all that badly, right? Even if it turns out to not be true. So I think that there's something to say about that response. But here's the thing. If you go in the Bible and you want to see how the Apostle Paul responded to that same question, what if your way of life, Paul, turns out to be based on falsehood and there is no God? Paul doesn't just say, well, it was a good and noble life anyway. Instead, the Apostle Paul said this, if only for this life, have hope in Christ. If that's it, there's nothing after this life, and our hope in Christ is only good for this temporary existence here, we are to be pitied more than all men. He said it's a waste. You look at other translations, he says, of most men, miserable I would be. We'd be the most miserable people in the world. We're worse off than anyone else. One translation in the Message translated that pitied more than all, as we're a pretty sorry lot. Paul didn't go for the thing, well, you know, it was a noble life anyway. He says, we're to be pitied worse than anybody. And right after that, this is what he said right after that, okay? He said, we are to be pitied more than all men, but the fact is that Christ has been raised from the dead. He has become the first of a great harvest of those who will be raised to life again. So I'm thinking, well, yeah, I mean, that's he didn't teeter-totter at all. But I'm thinking, why is Paul's answer so exact opposite? Why didn't he just say, listen, if Christ isn't raised from the dead, even if there is no God, it's still a life of love, labor, and sacrifice, and that's a good life to live. But instead, he said, without the reward of resurrection, we're to be pitied more than all people. And I have to tell you that I think the answer seems to be that the Christian life for Paul was not the so-called good life of prosperity and ease. When Paul decided to go into ministry, he didn't get a nice little white steepled church with a parsonage next door two blocks from the beach. He didn't get one of them deals. Instead, it was a life of freely chosen suffering beyond anything we ordinarily experience. Paul's belief in God and his confidence in the resurrection and his hope in the eternal fellowship of Christ didn't produce a life of comfort and ease that would have been satisfying even if there wasn't a resurrection. As a matter of fact, Paul says, are you kidding me? If this thing isn't true, then I'm one of the most miserable people in the world for all the things I have had to go through by having this belief system. As a matter of fact, Paul had the good life before he became a Christian. He had the big three P's: power, position, and he believed he had paradise. Power, position, and paradise. He had power because he was a Roman citizen. I mean, that's a serious position, and nobody could lay a hand on him without the approval of the judicial Roman system. So he had this power. He also had a position that he was one of the Sanhedrin. He was one of the most respected of the elite religious sects that there was, which was of the Pharisees. So he had it, man, and he's believed to even be on the Sanhedrin, which is sort of like being on the Senate. I mean, he had position. And lastly, he believed he had paradise. Now, don't forget, remember the two big religious groups during Jesus' day were the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Now, the Sadducees didn't believe in an afterlife, and that's why we always say that's why they were sad, you see. But the Pharisees believed that there was life after death as long as you lived a righteous life. And Paul, self-admittedly by his own admission, said he lived a righteous life, so he believed he had paradise. When he wrote to the Philippians, chapter 3, verse 6, he basically said this: I obeyed the Jewish law so carefully that I was never accused of any fault. So he had the whole deal. He figured he had his power, he had his position. He was on his way to paradise. So why would Paul ever want to change his belief system? There was no reason to want to do that. And that's one thing we have to be careful of, because lots of times what we believe is often based more on our desire than on truth. We believe what we desire to be true rather than what really is true. Didn't happen with Paul. As a matter of fact, the one thing that he found out to be true was probably the most humiliating and embarrassing revelation that he could have ever gotten. It was the complete polar opposite of everything that he was fighting against and fighting for. It was a stunning revelation that came through the risen Christ. You remember that? We did that about a year ago. He was on his way to Damascus to persecute this new movement that was rising up out of the Jewish sect. They were all, most of them were Jewish people, and they believed that this Jesus of Nazareth was a Messiah. He felt like it was a cult rising up in their midst. He was trying to suppress it and wipe it out. And in the middle of going up, he is figuring he's fighting for God. And as he's fighting and persecuting people, he felt for God, this bright light shines down on him. And it's God, and God says, great job, Paul. I'm glad you're wiping them out. No, he says, Paul, why are you persecuting me? What? Completely the opposite. Everything that he was fighting for and fighting against turns out to be God himself he's fighting against. Stunning revelation. And as a result, that powerful encounter and revelation he had gave him the ability to embrace suffering and a life that is hard for me to even imagine. And I think that's why Paul talked about depending on the power of God to believe, and not just wise and persuasive words. Because that's how he was converted. It's often said, listen, if somebody has talked you into believing this, then somebody can talk you out of believing this. Now, I'm not ruling out the vehicles by which God uses. He uses the foolishness of preaching, and sometimes he uses fool people to do it. Sometimes he uses your own journey and your study of this word when you're hungry for him. He can give you a dynamic revelation, just like he did Paul. We see other times in the Bible he speaks to people through dreams. That all has to be lined up with his word and his truth, but he uses all these vehicles. But the bottom line is, it's got to be God's power. It can't just be your intellectual reasoning. One of the things that Paul said, he goes, I don't want anybody to be converted just by using wise and persuasive words, because you know what? It empties the cross of its power. What can happen is people have an intellectual assent to some of the truths of the Bible, and we can get so professional at explaining them that they can have an intellectual decision to follow Christ. But nothing on the spiritual plane has really transformed their heart, because it's got to happen in the spiritual realm. And let's face it, in this world, with our rationalistic mindset, only the power of God. I mean, I sit down at our men's group sometimes, and I look at the variety of guys we have down there. We've got guys with incredibly responsible positions, smart guys. I sit there quiet most of the time because I'm afraid I'm going to say something. They're going to find out how dumb I really am, you know? I mean, these guys, you got to hear some of the stuff they come up with, you know? And I'm thinking, this is a miracle. These guys, a dead rabbi raised from the dead. They don't think it was metaphorical or, you know, fictitious stories to teach moral truths. They really believe it. It's a miracle. That's the power of God. And Paul says, listen, that's the only thing that's really going to make the difference. And that's why he wrote things like this, 1 Corinthians 1:18, where he said, for the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, to the lost. It sounds ridiculous. But to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. Another translation says, the message about the cross doesn't make sense to lost people. But for those of us who are being saved, it's God's power at work. I like that because it takes the pressure off of me. I'm not going to be able to persuade anybody here. All I can do is present the information, but only the power of the Holy Spirit can convince us. And you know, sometimes pastors, we can get a little, you know, excited. It's like Easter, there's going to be more people there, and maybe there'll be some people that really don't believe, you know, and if I just say the right thing or say it the right way, maybe they'll believe, you know. Jesus never sweated that. That's what I liked about Jesus. He never worried about saying it right so that somebody would get it. He just knew it was God's power. He would just tell the truth, lay it out there, and then you see, he says this phrase a lot, right at the end of, he says, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. That's great. I mean, he'd teach something intense, and then it'll be like, well, if you can hear that, great. You know, if not, I'll see you later. And I will see you later. You know, it's like, I'm not going to sweat it. And there's a couple, I mean, it's all over the Gospels. I went through it. I counted at least a dozen times he said that. I just put these two up there for an example. Matthew 11 is when he was, you know, the big thing, and some of you that came to our Seder or maybe had Seders on Friday, first night of Passover, we think it's such a huge thing to understand that because the Last Supper was part of a Seder, you know. And in that Seder, there's an extra seat that hangs out and an extra cup, but nobody's there. And the idea is that's for Elijah, because the concept, the biblical concept, is before the Messiah can come, Elijah's got to come. And you know, so these Jewish guys are starting to think that maybe Jesus is the Messiah. John the Baptist is getting really worried, though, because he's in jail, man, and he's a little worried that he's not going to make it out of there. And he sends the guys and says, would you just ask him again, is he definitely the Messiah? And then, so Jesus says, yeah, tell him all these things that have been happening according to the prophecy in Isaiah 61 and, you know, the blind see and the lame walk and all that stuff. But he knew that they were still wondering, well, where's Elijah then, man? If you're the Messiah, why hasn't Elijah come? And he said, well, he said, actually, he has. He's just come in the form of John the Baptist. John the Baptist is Elijah. He's fulfilled Elijah's role. And then he says, he who has ears, nope, keep it there, go on back. He who has ears, let him hear, all the way back to he who has ears. That's it. That's what he says. I mean, I'd be like, wait a minute. Can we have a Bible study? Can you explain this to me? Where are you going, Jesus? Hold it. Wait, you know. Another one, he'll just come up in Matthew 13. He just explains about the farmer. Remember that one with the seeds? And the farmer goes to plant the seeds, and some falls on hard ground, and some falls on rocky ground, some falls where there's thorns, and some actually grows, and it sprouts up. He does, and you know what? It says just before that huge crowds showed up. It was like Easter. It was like so huge that he had to go into the boat and get off the shore away from everybody so they could see him. And then he told this story. And then he just says that again. He who has ears, let him hear. He doesn't even explain it. Because Jesus only wants the ones that really want him. Do you really want him? And there was a small group of guys, and they chased after him, and they said, Jesus, what does that mean? You know, can you explain it a little further? And he says, well, yeah, listen, you guys are hungry for God, you know? You're not just coming out. You really want to know me. I'm going to tell you about it. And that's where he explains, you know? Well, the seed that fell on the hard ground, that's kind of like the people that just come out, you know, once in a while, but they're really not interested. Or the seed that came out, and then that one falls on another ground where it's all rocky, and then when things start getting tough and trials come, then, well, they really kind of give up the whole thing. And he explains the whole thing, and then he goes into one last one where he says, let me tell you one other story, guys. He says, it's another farmer story because most of them had to grow their own food so they could relate to that. And he said, this one's about a farmer who planted all this wheat. And then he was sleeping. He was sleeping, and an enemy of his came in and planted all these weeds in the middle of his wheat field, and they grew up. And his hands, his helper said, well, gosh, you want us to go out and pull the weeds? And they said, no, don't do that, because if you pull the weeds, you might pull up some of the good plants too. So just leave them, let them all grow up together, and then at the harvest, we'll sort out the wheat from the weeds. And then he explained it, and he talked about the one, the enemy that came in and sowed the bad seed is the devil, and the harvest where he sorts out the weeds from the wheat is the end of the world. And then Jesus says this. Check this out. This is what he said. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the fiery furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. And then he ends it that way again. He who has ears, let him hear. I'd be like, listen, I'll tell you what, I'm glad Jesus isn't a guest speaker here this morning. I mean, I'd probably, you know, I'm the people pleaser. I'd probably feel obligated to apologize for him. Well, you know, he had a long flight, 12 hours from Israel. He's pretty tired. And I don't know, you know, what I'm not so sure. I don't think that's really what he meant. What he really meant was what he said. See, here's the thing, people. We're talking about God of the infinite universe. This unfathomable expanse of galaxies and everything in it. And if he's telling me the way things are, if he's really the Son of God, I mean, basically, who am I to argue with him? He's telling me the way things are. Isn't it a little arrogant of me to question him if he's the God of all the galaxies in the universe? Actually, he has the right to question me more than I have the right to question him. You know, some guys in our men's group, too, they like J. Vernon McGee. I don't get to listen to him much anymore. Because not in the car, you know, I mean, my commute has significantly downsized since I came here from the city. But I used to put them on once in a while, and I used to have a paper route early in the morning, you know, just trying to make ends meet. And I would have him on, and I always liked his voice. You know, he died, I think, like 25 years ago or something, but he already sounded old when he made those shows. I mean, he's got that, you ever hear him kind of like a scratchy, slight southern drawl, you know? But I always remember one thing that he said that I really liked, and he's like, this is God's universe, and he does things his way. You may think you have a better way, but you don't have a universe. I thought, man, that's great. I mean, that's so simple, but it just sums it up, you know? It's like, well, I don't think Jesus should have said anything like that. I mean, you don't have a universe. This is his place. He makes the rules. I would like to change them, but it's not my universe. It's unbelievable. I mean, truth is, we should be looking up at this huge, unfathomable, great God and be like, I can be forgiven by you? You died for me? Are you kidding me? No way, man. No way. You got to be kidding me. You know, right at the end of this, what Jesus said here, that's what he said. That's basically what he said. Maybe you don't like the rules, but that's really what it's like. Check it out. Here's how he said it. This has become one of my favorite verses. A lot of you know I've been using this one a lot. He said, listen, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, and when a man found it, he was like, wow, no way. So he hid it again, and in his joy, you're kidding me, he went and and buried it, and he sold everything he had because it was so valuable. Wow, I can't believe this. He would die for me, this little insignificant speck on the smallest planet in the whole solar system. Whoa! When you really are touched by the power of the risen Christ, everything else pales in comparison. And don't get me wrong, the power of Christ, like I said, can use any means. It could be a dynamic encounter. I love in the book of Acts where it just shows him using the foolishness of preaching. Don't you love that? In the book of Acts, Peter preaches after the day of Pentecost, and these people get it. It's like the power of God. I mean, you read a sermon, it's pretty cool. I mean, a lot of good stuff there. But, I mean, in today's world, I've heard some that are probably, just by reading it, look more fancy and more engaging than what he had to say. But the power of God was there, and thousands of people were like, wow, this is amazing. Where do we sign up? And Peter was like, repent and go immerse yourself in that water over there. The Greek word for immerse is baptize. And you know what amazes me? There's no record in here that any of the people were like, go in all the way in that water? I mean, I really didn't want to get my hair wet today. I didn't bring a change of clothes. Is there any way we could set this up tomorrow? I mean, they were like, God wants me to go in that water? Then I'm cannonballing in there, man. Are you kidding me? This treasure is so stinking amazing. I'll do whatever, man, whatever he wants. Whoa, I mean, that's the God I worship. And you know what? God knows he's great. And I think he is too. And I just want to end. I'm going to ask the worship team to come up here. I want to just worship God. I've decided I want to take how great thou art. It's number 33 in your hymnal. And I just want us to, let's belt it out. Let's let it rip. And maybe you're still questioning the value of that treasure. Maybe you don't know. You're not sure. Well, then just be honest with God and say, God, I need you to reel me in. I need you to make the revelation clearer. The most amazing thing is that you don't have to work your way up to it. You don't have to somehow become good enough. You just accept the fact that he's paid the price for you, and you receive it as a gift. Jesus is like, here it is. You want it? You're ready to give everything up for it? Then it's yours. Here. Take it. Have it. Come on, let's stand. I'm going to see if I can find